4 different aliases, 4 different social security numbers, 4 different dates of birth, credit histories, and I had to learn every one of them. That case was the culmination of my career, and it was also the demise of my career. My iron walls would go up. I didn't have any emotional intelligence I had today, and I would just shut down. I had to do a mental health check every 6 to 9 months when I was operational with the government. That was a game changer for me. I wasn't trained on heart rate variability, breathing techniques. I went that extra mile because I invested in myself so much. And Lakeview is great for that. We do a family component. So we don't only just treat the first responder, we'll treat the family as well. Life worth is tremendous. I'm a game changer. That's a superpower.
Welcome to Responder Resilience, along with my co-host Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with retired LEO and FBI covert operative Giovanni Rocco to talk about mitigating the mental health challenges faced by first responders and awareness about the risks of substance abuse and addiction. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is, we're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV. PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, ResponderTV.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Giovanni after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB. Today we're joined by Giovanni Rocco. He's a retired law enforcement officer and federal covert operative with more than 30 years of service and training experience. Giovanni is the author of the book, Giovanni's Ring, My Life Inside the Real Sopranos, which details his most difficult undercover role and the years he spent as an FBI covert agent inside the Italian-American mafia. Giovanni contributes to the development of mental health and rehabilitation programs designed to engage and strengthen resiliency of our nation's law enforcement community. He acquired these insights and strategies through years of exemplary service with local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. Giovanni's lectured throughout the United States and internationally, training thousands of public safety and military professionals in the fields of trauma stress identification and mitigation, leadership and management, effective communication skills, de-escalation, conflict resolution, and the importance of mental health for first responders. Giovanni, warm welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It's nice to get to talk to you finally. So let's just jump right in without further ado. For those listeners who didn't know about your background as an FBI undercover agent, you were able to infiltrate a New Jersey crime family. We'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that situation and the double life that you were tasked in leading during that time.
Sure. That case was the culmination of my career, and it was also the demise of my career. It was effective, it was successful, but ultimately, for me and my family, was not. Unfortunately, it caused me to retire after 26 years of service. But it was some of the greatest work I've done, right? And as we all know, with the training and experience we have on the job, everything we do makes us better and creates more opportunities in that field. So it really was the coup de grace for my undercover career. I had a long history doing it, probably 25 years of working undercover work. That was a tough one, though, because we're trained to have emotional intelligence. We're trained to have effective communication. But when you're deep cover, as opposed to just doing short term undercovers, deep cover is much worse. I had to take on the role like I did for many years. I had 4 different aliases, 4 different social security numbers, 4 different dates of birth, credit histories. And I had to learn every one of them and had to live in each life. So I would come out of one case and go into another. So that kind of is how I was living at that time. That's what I feature in the book. I talk about my career, how I came to be, and how I infiltrated the mafia, how it was not something that was planned. It was just who I was born, where I was raised in New Jersey, and I had a good understanding of it. And it was just my ability to ingratiate into that community. So, yeah.
Well, the book is it's a great read. I would recommend it to anyone. And the story that you document in that book, Giovanni's Ring, My Life Inside the Real Sopranos, it reads like a movie script, and it really brings to light the psychological cost resulting from the undercover work you did. So what kind of toll did it take on you and your family?
I had it all under control. I was an expert, so I thought. And, you know, I lied to myself and I fooled myself very much so through my whole career as a first responder, similar to trauma. You know, I'm mitigating trauma like great, you know, I do a great job, you know, so we tell ourselves, but we really don't. And it was that's why I call it Giovanni's Ring. I thought I was mitigating all of my trauma and my time away from my family. And I thought I had a good balance mentally. I was trained to do this all over the world. The government made me an asset. They gave me great resources for my mental health. I had to do a mental health check every 6 to 9 months when I was operational with the government. And that was a game changer for me. So early in my career, when I was an undercover, I didn't have that training. All I had was what I learned in the streets of New Jersey and maybe a couple of undercover things or some, you know, little trainings they gave me along the way. But it was the understanding I had that when they started to do the mental health checks, and I thought I had a good balance. But like anything else I do, I love my job and I love my career. I would go down rabbit holes. I mean, maybe it's my ADHD, it kicks in. Mm-hmm. So I came up with the idea of wearing a pinky ring that was a government-issued pinky ring that came out of the Hoover building. And every night I came home when I was able to make it home to my family, and I left that undercover world behind, I would purposely take off this ring that belonged to the government and I would leave it in my ashtray or my cup holder in my truck. And that was my mental health. I checked out of being Giovanni Gatto. I wasn't Giovanni Gatto anymore. I had to go back to being Giovanni Rocco. So for years I did that. And I thought, I have a pretty good balance. But I was only lying to myself. Because when you're dealing in that world every day, it's not that I bought into the sexiness of being somebody else or the sexiness of being a mob guy. It's just when you're living that life of constant hypervigilance and you're living a life of, tomorrow's meeting is just another business meeting, but I could wind up dead tomorrow. You know, the guys I was dealing with were all murderers. They were all career criminals. So, yeah. And I had to find a balance of being a husband, you know, go back to being a husband in my real world. I am married to a law enforcement officer. So she saw it and she warned me, you're changing. Things are not the same. This is going to ruin our career. But my addiction to adrenaline, my addiction to my role as an undercover, it just drove me in a different way. So.
David and I don't know anything about that as first responders, just so you know. You know, I wanted to boil it down even further to you. Do you feel that part of what you were going through psychologically was that fear taking over? Like the fear of having that split moment where you would show vulnerability or you would slip up, maybe, shall we say, and one of them would pick up on that with you?
Sure. Yeah. You're always in a state of your emotional roller coaster that you're on. Again, it's hard enough to live who we are naturally born, right? It's hard enough to be ourselves, but then when you're faking to be somebody else. I remember looking back, Bonnie, I did a white supremacist case. And all I had to do was get 5 different hotel rooms and check the heads of the white supremacist organizations. I had to just check them into a room in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And I paid for it on my undercover credit card. But I was so, like you said, I was deregulated emotionally. And it wasn't fear. It's just the uncomfortableness of being found out. Again, these violent people hovering over your shoulder. So here I am. I'm handing out the keys to the hotel rooms. These guys are the most vicious in their pack. And I put the credit card in. And I signed my true name because I was just like, so now what do you do? And I was like, you know what? And I turned right into a gangster. I said, you know what? I didn't want to use that credit card. Let me use another one. Forget that, you know, cancel that transaction. But here I was, and I signed clear as a bell. So just those little things, if you slip up along the way, when you're living a double life or a triple life or a quadruple life, you better know who you are, you know? It's tough emotionally. And the fear is always there. If you don't have fear, any undercover, any police officer or any first responder tells you don't have fear, then they're either they're a psychopath or some kind of serious issues and slip through the cracks, right? Because they're just lying to themselves and then lying to you. a good amount, and you probably know better than anybody, a good amount of fear is a healthy thing. You should have fear. When you're going into a situation, your heart should be pounding, right? But the difference is when I realized how I control that, I became aware. I wasn't trained on heart rate variability, breathing techniques. I wasn't trained. I went that extra mile to learn about it because I invested in myself so much. And I bet now when you harness that and use it as a weapon, everything in my life changed in my undercover world. I wasn't quite deploying it in my true life because I didn't realize the importance of it then. Because again, my hyper focus was I need to be a great undercover. I need to survive this operation. I could be, you know, I could travel all over the world and do an op. So I might not have traditionally everybody thinks you go into it and you hit the panic button and the SWAT team's going to come in. That wasn't the case in our world. Our world, you know, most of my cases, I was alone. If I was with a couple of undercovers, we were only safety lines. Maybe I brought an informant in, but who wants to, are you going to rely on an informant? They're going to crack. They have no training. They're going to crack and throw you under the bus right away. So a good amount of fear is a healthy thing. But it's how you harness it. That's it. You know, you can use it as a weapon.
Come on. Check it.
In terms of the family, just to touch back on that, what do first responders need to know about, you know, how that affects, how their job affects the family or an assignment like yours affects the family? Like, are they making unwitting sacrifices as a result of the job?
We do. The minute we held our hand up and put our hand on the Bible and raised our right hand and swore that oath, we sacrificed our life and our well-being. And we didn't know, people didn't tell us how much our life would change and how callous we may become. But the folks who are standing next to us are the folks that we married along the way or the kids that we had along the way. There's a whole transference of trauma, you know, that we don't consider. I think there needs to be a little more attention that goes into that, a little more explanation that goes into it when you come on this job. It should be part of it. I know they're kind of leaning the right way and trying to put a little more mental health into it, but the family unwittingly and unknowingly sacrifices. Right? And I am married to a police officer and we both did the work, but still, you know, we still would be like keep each other at a distance. We'd be deregulated. You know, you would think like, oh, you understand, you both work undercover. That wasn't the case. There's a huge transference of trauma.
So could you talk a little bit about what the healing and the reparation of that marriage and parenthood is when once a person realizes this and they realize they're in distress and their job has really impacted. What does that repair and healing look like for you?
For me, it was focused on, it was greedy in the beginning. It was all about me, right? I didn't realize what I had put my family through. At the end, when my family had to be relocated, I didn't really put any thought into it. It was just like, okay, we need to relocate. We all need to retire. We need to change our life. And then it was the guilt of me going through that. I had to process the fact that my career ended and it ended on a, not on a sour note, but it didn't end the way I wanted to. But because I planned on doing this job till I was 65 years old. And then when I retired, I was younger than 50 years old. So I had to go through almost, and I write about it in the book, and my co-author Doug Schofield actually touched on it and interviewed my wife for the book. And she actually described it, and it really set a light, turned a light on a lot brighter in my head. Her understanding of it. She was the one who had a great understanding of how I came out of that case. The criminals are criminals, but it was her understanding of knowing that it was almost as if I suffered a death in the family or I lost a family. My target, I didn't love my targets, right? You know, I knew they were bad people, but when they look out for you and, you know, they tell you they care for you like your family and they treat you like family, that could lull you to sleep, you know. And for the love of the job, for the good of the job, right? We all do it as first responders. But it wasn't until later on, until I cleaned my own act up and I started to put my own life together, that I realized, holy cow, I left I really destroyed my life. I destroyed my kids' lives. You know, I didn't realize the trauma I had set in. So now it's time to repair that. I could either go down a rabbit hole. See, for me, it was great because I was still presenting. I was still speaking on behalf of the Bureau, and I was speaking and training. So that was good for me. But what about my family? So it wasn't until I really started to understand the trauma I put them through that I said, okay, I got to start focusing more on what I can do to family. Be around a little bit more. Be a little more attentive. Be there, right? Be there when I'm physically there. See, I didn't pay attention to that, like a lot of us do. We come home from the job, and we come home, and we're physically on the couch, and we're physically sitting next to our kids and our family. We might have one of the kids sitting on that, but we're mentally checked out. Mm-hmm. So it's that reeling yourself in and really holding the mirror up and looking at yourself and saying, am I constantly, my wife would say, you're here, but you're not. Why don't you go out to date with your friends? Why don't you go live with your gangster friends? And, you know, why don't you, if you don't want to be here, don't come home. And I'd be like, what are you talking about? I'm home. I came home for the purpose of being around you guys. But all I did was, again, I would sit on a couch or I'd sit somewhere and I would crash. I would just fall asleep. And she'd be like, what are you doing? Are you out drinking and partying all the time? Like in her mind, she's thinking these things. Same thing with any first responder's wife. Mm-hmm. We don't take the time to teach them, or they don't take the time. The departments and our peer teams don't take the time to speak to the spouses and let them know, listen, they're coming home not because they're just, you know, not paying attention to you. There's a mental exhaustion, a physical exhaustion. That's why they crashed down on the couch.
So it
took us a while. And it's still, you're never cured. It's just treatable, right?
Right.
It's like having a disease and you can manage it. Everybody goes, well, how'd you get through it? I'm not. I still have my bad days. I still have my angry days. That's how I, you know, what do? Am I a little more aware? You know, some days I don't catch myself if I'm tired, if I'm mentally drained or something's going on. Mm-hmm.
So can you pivot a little bit into how did you get into thinking about a book and telling your story?
So the book was, I never intended to write a book. What happened to me was, I told you I had to go for mental health checks. And everything I did in my career, I had some great cases I worked. This Italian mafia case was not the greatest case I worked. Just happened to be a high profile because everybody loves the mafia. But there were, you know, my file was probably this thick, whereas your average undercover might be that way. And I would go for my mental health checkups. Even my therapist would be like, hey, when you retire, you're going to write a series of books, right? You can't move. And it used to make me so mad, right? Because I'm like, I'm not a narcissist. So it would make me angry. And then when I did start to teach for the Bureau and do some trainings and just do law enforcement and first responder trainings, everywhere I went globally, people would always ask me, you're going to write a book. But it was the therapist that recommended, listen, Giovanni, I just recommend that you do a journal. You keep a journal, like a daily or weekly or monthly journal. And again, I got mad being a first responder. I'm like, what am I, a 13-year-old girl? I'm going to keep it. You know? And I say that to him, like, what am I, 13-year-old? I'm not going to keep it. And anyway, if you know law enforcement, any notes we take could be used in court. So I was real skeptical of it. But I took to it and I started. I bought a one subject notebook and I started writing some thoughts and I write things down. And then I come home and when I reflected back, and then I met my co-author who helped me write the book, and he was great. And when I met him, I promised him, if I ever decide to do a book, you'll be the first guy I call. I'm never going to do it, you know. But then one day he asked me, and I let him into my world, and I let him read my journals. And I had one subject, three subject, which turned into five subject notebooks. So it was all there. It was there. But looking back, Bonnie, it was so great because I could literally read my writing and see where I was at that time. It gave me such great material for the book because I reflected back to how I thought. When I came home one night and tried to decompress, and again, the family that I was in was the Di Cavalcanti family. They're the family that The Sopranos is based on. Mm-hmm. So here I was in the middle of my case, and I was in the mob. I was helping run a crew. I was committing crimes, and I'm reporting to the bosses of this crime family. And James Gandolfini passed away, Tony Soprano. Mm-hmm. And they had that whole tribute to him on HBO. So here I was, either in my undercover apartment where I was at home trying to decompress, and one of these episodes would be on. So I wrote about that and how it made me feel. And looking back, you know, it was healing for me. And now what I do is I keep a positive journal. Anything that I have a positive thought, that goes into one subject or a separate book. Mm-hmm. So if I do want to look for some inspiring stuff, if I'm having some dark times or I'm going through something, I can look back in that and find my own thinkings and find my own thoughts that I had a positive thought, you know. I know I recommended to guys just the other day here at Lakeview Health. I recommended it to our guys that are here for treatment that, you know, maybe keep a positive journal, you know, because you don't want to go back to the darkness. It's good to write about the darkness, but I don't want to keep reflecting on it. I don't want to look in the dark to find light. You know, that one notebook or that one journal is just, you know, call it power of positive thinking or whatever you want to label it, and just know, you know.
Well, I think for our viewers and listeners to hear that speaking your truth, it's not only healing, but the moment that you're able to speak your truth, you step into the future, right? You because you're no longer wallowing in the pain of that period of time in your life. You know, and as a therapist, that's what I tell clients, but I really wish first responders would do more of this. And for some people, it's writing in a journal. For some people, it's singing it out. For some people, it's dancing it out. Like, whatever your thing is, we're going to be interviewing an amazing artist who is in Canada in a couple of weeks, and he gets it out in his artwork. Mm-hmm. So I would say whatever that thing is for you, harness it and do it, because that's when you're going to start to move into the light and away from your darkness.
I agree 100%. And in our world, first responder world, it can be very uncomfortable to go into that right. area, because right. you look at, or you're afraid of what your peers think of you or what they might say about you, right?
That's right.
If they find out you signed up for the Fred Astaire dance class on a Sunday night, you know, they'll make fun of you.
Yeah,
but when you really mature in this world, in the first responder world, and those jokes, listen, it's how we abuse each other and make fun of each other, cope, yeah. right? And it's fun. But then we become very vicious too. And I think a lot of people fear that. Right. But it's almost as if when you understand your own, what works for me works for me. I'm not worried about it. For me, I used to grow my beard long, my hair long. And I caught a lot of flack for that. My earrings in my ears in my early career. And cops would look at me, and the old salty cops would make fun of me, and call me a sissy or whatever they said about me. But I'd be like, you know what? That's your issue, you know. But I'm third generation police too. So I was taught to be callous. I was taught how to process I have experienced this job and every traumatic thing you could, you know. I'm fortunate that I never had to take a life. But outside of that, I've experienced everything this job had to offer. And I was taught by my two generations before me how to mitigate that. And that is to drink until you get drunk, go out with your buddies, go get it off your chest, stay out all night, you know. You have a badge and a gun, it gives you authority to keep a bar open as long as you want, right? In our backyard, you know, I determined when the bar closed, where I could always find a bar that was open with my buddies. I was taught the wrong way, you know, and I look back at my dad and my grandfather, and they did it the wrong way, you know, because they didn't have the ability to have the openness and the communication we have today. The peer teams, they didn't have that back then. We didn't have it when I was on the job either. I mean, 30 years ago, we didn't have peer teams.
Yeah, it's pretty recent.
Yeah. You went for help. You know, the guys that I knew that went for treatment, they went to, you know, 30 days. They got dry. They came home. They went to the first PBA meeting. And then here's all their peers were trying to get them to have a drink. You know, why?
Yeah.
Because really it was the community that I felt uncomfortable that you know, Giovanni might have went and got treatment. And now that I'm sober and I'm in a good place, it doesn't make you comfortable that I'm in a good place, you know, and you're not. So it's my goal to knock you off the top of the hill, right? Mm-hmm. It's a vicious community we survive in.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes we're our own worst enemies in terms of how we treat each other in that community.
Yeah.
In terms of you touched on Lakeview Health and decompressing. How did woodworking play a role in decompressing during your undercover days, and then how do you share that or pay it forward with first responders today?
Yeah, I'm blessed. My construction background. So when I was a kid growing up in the streets, and my grandfather, he always did some kind of work on the side, like a lot of firemen or police do. And that was his thing. And God forbid you were sitting on the front stoop and he came outside and said, what are you doing? And you said, nothing. All right, good. You made some cement all day. Let's go. So I am truly blessed because of those little things. But again, as my undercover persona, when I grew my hair out and I was a young undercover biker, I used to work construction on the side. So I had an understanding of it. But then I always liked to tinker. And I always did woodworking and crafting of some sort. And when I came home, that was my thing. Right? When I came home, I locked myself in the garage. I love to create things and do woodworking and stuff like that. But I had to control that too, because sometimes I would come home and go, well, I need to go out in the garage. I'm going to go out and make a, you know, and I did, like David's referring to, I do the wood-burned American flag.
Oh, and, flag yeah.
And I love it. And that's my thing. And just using that one project, I really enjoy it because it's my mindfulness, right? It's how I can unplug and decompress. But it's also, I even have to watch it today because I can go down a rabbit hole and I'm just going to be 1 hour out in the garage and then we can go to dinner. Then we'll go to dinner. 4 hours, 5 hours later, it's the kids are in bed and I'm doing the same thing I did when I was operational and on the job. You still have to catch yourself. So yeah, it was great because it did allow me to disconnect, David. It allowed me and it still does. Now I do it and I want to implement it here at Lakeview and with our programs and our guys and girls. And it gives them something to take home if they create a flag that they build on their own here in a healthy place. You know, listen, maybe their thing is not to hang the serenity flag, serenity prayer in their house. Maybe they're just not there yet. But if they hang that distress flag, it reminds them where they were, where they are, where they're going. So, you know, it's just a positive thing. And I use it to pay it forward. It kind of works. And again, it doesn't have to be woodworking. It could be basket weaving. It could be knitting. You know, it sounds silly, right? But whatever works for you. You find what works for you. It's dancing, whatever it is.
So knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to current first responders in this world about mitigating their own stress and trauma and really how to take care of themselves in this moment so that they don't have to learn the hard way like you?
A lot of times I tell them, hold themselves up to be the professional that they are. We don't give ourselves enough credit, and be open and honest with your communication. When you see something, when you see the worst of the worst and you see some of the things, and it doesn't have to be a horrific, gory scene that we see. Sometimes it could just be the way a family is living. And, you know, it could send us in a spiral when we see, you know, somebody doesn't have as much as we have. You know, we work hard and then we go to these families and see how they live. And it could be depressing at times. Find yourself. And if it bothers you and you go to a crime scene, whatever bothers you, talk about it. Be open with your communications. Find a good outlet, find a culturally competent therapist, you know, not a therapist that's going to be shock and awe when you go and tell them, you know, I was at this MVA, this motor vehicle accident today, and it was a horrific one. It's okay to feel, you know, deregulated from that. You should, because like I said before, if you're numb to that and you truly are callous, then you're burned out where it comes to the job and you need to get help because you're not yourself. You're not the guy. But yeah, it's open communication is everything, right? And find somebody, find a therapist that you can speak with. Because again, the departments aren't going to do it. The departments will give you peer teams and they'll give you peer support. Right. Listen, you know, a doctor, a lawyer, anybody in a profession, when they're given their certificates of graduation, and I'd say this all the time, where's the firm? When you go to a dentist or you go to a doctor or you go to a lawyer's office, their certificates are hanging on the wall. Mm-hmm. We graduate. You graduate the fire academy, the police academy. Where do you put that? A small majority maybe will keep it someplace displayed, but most of us stick it in a file and leave it there for 20 to 25 years until we retire and go, hey, I really should put that up on the wall with all my other awards, you know? So we don't hold ourselves to a higher standard, you know? And the departments need to do a better job of giving us services, mental health services, and debrief us. You know, you debriefed me after every op I did, after every single op I did. You gave me a mental health check every 6 to 9 months. That was such a game changer for me. Right. See, and as a police officer, I was a task force officer. I still had to worry about going back to my department. See, what happens if I fail one of these 6 to 9 month mental health checks? Like, what happens to me? I'll lose my job. But that's why I was so invested in it. And at first I had so much trauma. And one of my darkest traumas I carried around was actually a fire incident. It was a victim in a fire that I had to hold, and you know, it was a terrible thing, and I carried that for years. And it wasn't until I started really opening up and talking about it that somebody said to me, well, what do you think the triggers are? And I didn't know what triggers. As a young cop, I didn't understand triggers. But then when I started to really understand it, it was somebody, it was a culturally competent person that broke it down for me. And they're like, Giovanni, every time you go to a family barbecue or with my ex-wife, I'd go to a barbecue, I'd always become irritable. I'd always be like, ah. And I always blamed it, fame as Bonnie. Well, these people aren't my people. They don't get it. You know, you brought me around a room full of civilians, a backyard full of civilians. I don't want to be around these people.
Right.
But really what it was, and he helped me understand, it was the burning meat, the smell of the meat.
Right.
It was the senses. It could be sight. It could be sound. It could be smells. They're triggers. Mm-hmm. And then when I understood that, I was like, wait a minute, you're right. And he said to me, listen, it depends on the fat content. It depends on this. Like, you become irritable. So is it because you were drinking at the barbecue, or was it just a trigger? And then all of a sudden, I would just, my iron walls would go up, and emotionally, I didn't have the emotional intelligence I have today, and I would just shut down. Mm-hmm. Now, when you have an understanding of that, now I can use it, I can harness that and reframe it. We talk a lot about that, reframing it, right? Reframing the trauma. And if I can figure out a way to help you reframe the trauma, like somebody helped me, I don't carry that child around anymore, that trauma that I had. Now I reframe it to be, the mom is probably long dead, or whatever parents she had. And, you know, so now I carry that child's memory to honor that child, not to haunt me, to honor her, you know? So that's kind of how I reframe it. And that's how you can mitigate it. A lot of EMDR work. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Well, you know, that was going to be my next question to you, actually, because myself and my colleague, Stacy, who's not on today, we're both EMDR therapists. Mm-hmm. And to be an EMDR therapist, you also have to be a recipient of it. So we understand it very, very well. Right. And what I was going to ask you, we've talked about it a lot on this podcast and a lot of back episodes that we have. Wondering from you, do you feel like in the FBI culture, EMDR, trauma-informed therapists, are those commonplace, or is that something that's really relatively recent in the history of the FBI?
No, it's all recent, if it's even deployed now. Again, it should be something that's implemented early on. It should be something that's given after every traumatic event, every crime scene. There should be a, you know, your SOPs, like your operation procedure, should be that of, well, if there's a fatal, if there's something there and it's emotional, like, you don't have to go through a whole session. You know, you just sit down with the professional, and then maybe you do some those who haven't or are not familiar with EMDR, it is tremendous. Right. But in our folks, our community, first responders, and you probably witnessed this, Bonnie, one session. And it's almost like that show, that movie, Analyze This, when Robert, you're good. You fixed me. I'm done. You're good. Good. I'm good. Fine. Thank you very much. I can go about my 20-year career now. And you're like, wait a minute. No. I feel good.
You know, I want those quick results.
They love it because we're famous for that, right? So it is, right? And that's what I love about what Lakeview does is they introduce you. They start to build a foundation. Right? And they're very careful the way they go about EMDR, because once you're exposed to it, you feel that cold. It's like taking a cold shower and waking up, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I feel refreshed. I feel great. I feel weight lifted off me. These are things people say. But you have to remember, it's muscle memory. So it's like working out. You have to build and build and build towards it. So they start the foundation here, and then it's just something that you continue to do on outpatient. But the Bureau, definitely, I think all across the nation at every level, local, state, and federal, need to have more modalities, whether it's rapid resolution, whether it's EMDR, you need to have more there. You know, if you're going to have an EAP or a peer team set up, you have to have the ability to just sit with the guys and girls, you know. Especially, I know a lot of guys who are ex-military guys, mm-hmm. and they've been involved in shootings and on the job. And some of my good friends, and, you know, the unfortunate thing of taking a life, and they go, well, I'm good with it. The fact that you just said, I'm good with it, it means you're not. Like,
mm-hmm. Right.
Have you talked to somebody? No. I was in the military. I did 2 tours. This stuff rolls off me. That's not the case, you know. Mm-mm. Can't just say that, you know.
No.
And the fear of all the first responders. I'm afraid that you're going to find me not fit for duty, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and you might take my badge. You might take my ability to provide for my family, and then what? You know, so it's a lot of fear that's built up in our community too.
But yeah, probably what comes with the emotional intelligence, you know, after you've done EMDR is you know when you need a tune-up, so to speak, right? You need to go back for 1 or 2 sessions from a particularly traumatic call or something that's come bubbling up that you need to deal with. But I know, Bonnie, you see that a lot, right? Where first responders, sometimes they know they need it, sometimes they don't, but maybe that's your time when you remind them.
I do. And what's neat now is that I've been doing EMDR with first responders long enough that I have a bunch of people that are on maintenance mode. And so I'm just kind of on standby. And when that bad call comes in, I'm going to get the phone call. They'll come in for 1 or 2 and they'll go back to life. It's not going to be, you know, we're processing their whole life anymore because we've done that. So if we could get first responders to think preventatively, they think preventatively in their job all the time, right? Like, why do police officers go and build relationships in the communities they work in, right? Why do firemen go and hold clinics on changing the batteries and fire detection? I mean, teaching CPR for EMS, a lot of the things that we do are so preventative. This should be a no-brainer. Like, we should be so good at this. And that's why, you know, David and I keep shouting from the rooftops about these things. And I'm a firm believer that the more we talk about it, the more people we get involved in it, like yourself and others, that one day this will just be the norm and the gold standard. And we won't have to fight the battle anymore. We'll have won.
Sure. I agree with that 100%. And in the end, you are the person you're going to, I say it all the time in my presentations, like, we owe it to our family to be the candidate before we came on the job. We owe it in 25, we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to the family to be the same person at the end of 25 years. And they go, oh, you can't possibly, all the stuff we've seen, you can do it. Everything that you're talking about is preventive maintenance. For me, it was preventative maintenance. When you start to look at your career a little bit differently and go, yeah, you know what? I need a little bit of a tune-up. You know, I can't keep going undercover. I can't keep showing up at fatal accidents. I can't keep being homicide, the great homicide detective. You know, and it's no offense to people that are just, you can see when you watch these shows on TV, you know, pick whatever fire show, police show, or if it's one of these reality shows, look at these guys and girls. Look how unhealthy and unfit they are sometimes, you know, because they're just so burned out and they're so depressed. And you can continue your job, you know, homicide after homicide after homicide, just it wears on you, right? Mm-hmm. You can still be a great homicide investigator, a great detective, but... and I just had these conversations yesterday. Like, one guy was saying to me, you know, I my family is just, you know, I'm situationally aware everywhere I go. I'm a typical cop. My back is, you know, never to the door and this and that. Well, there's a difference between being situationally aware and hypervigilant, right?
Right.
And you can be extremely hypervigilant, like way over the top, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, and it's good to come out of your comfort zone, maybe once in a while, you know, and a lot of guys, especially law enforcement, they can never have their back to the door. Me as a gangster, I used to say, I always want my back to the door because it's proven the point. And guys would say, yeah, you want to face the door? You want to? No, why? I don't fear any man. Anything. But again, I'm not hypervigilant. My head's not always on a swivel. Guys go, oh, my head's on a swivel all the time. I'm a SWAT guy. I'm a first, you know, I'm one of these rapid teams. They just get over hyper, you know, hyper focused, you know. And again, learn how to do your breath work. Learn about breath work. Breath work is tremendous. Game changer. That's a superpower, breath work.
You know, I love what you're bringing up as well, like that first responders aren't taught and they're not aware, right? So I had a situation where a couple of law enforcement buddies asked me if I wanted to go shooting in a trailer. You know, the ones that have the scenarios in the back and 3D on the screen. And I said, yeah, because I had never done something like that. And I went and I did it. And the responsibility, even for myself, of shooting and holding that weapon and being just hyper present in that moment. Afterward, I remember being exhausted. And I said to one of my friends, like, what do you guys do to come down from this cortisol dump? And he said, what the heck is cortisol? Right. And I said, oh my God, I got to get back to work. I really have to do more work here.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's so important. We're putting people out there and they don't even know what's happening in their brain and body. They know what's going on outside of themselves better than inside. And that's so troubling to me.
Right. Right. It's also where, you know, in the academies, we're spending a lot of time focusing on the physical element, fitness and, you know, yeah, muscle memory for skills and things like that, but not so much on the emotional, mental aspects of it. But there's change in the works. We're starting to hear some good stuff about new inclusions into textbooks for EMS, fire, and law enforcement, and also in the academy level, starting to introduce some modules that do address mental health and the emotional component. And Giovanni, I wanted to have you talk a little bit more about Lakeview Health and some of the programs they offer. It sounds like they're doing some great stuff. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I kind of fell into this work. I was retired for a while. I was doing some security work. I was doing some anti-human trafficking work. And I was putting myself into other dangers, right? Because I missed the adrenaline and I missed everything that I was craving. And I was doing these crazy, you know, crazy things all over the world and trainings and just putting myself in situations that I probably should not have after putting my family through so much. But a speaking engagement came along and a culturally competent therapist of mine, a friend of mine, he is a psychologist, police psychologist, and he did a presentation. And then eventually he had asked me to give him a hand in this world of recovery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not being an addict or I thought I would fit, you know, I wouldn't be in, how can I help these guys and girls? I don't. You know, but the more I understood trauma and I really went down that rabbit hole of understanding, like Bonnie said, cortisol, heart rate variability and all this, the vagus nerve. And I really went down, you know, so I brought some of my training and everything I brought to it. And I realized how important it could be. Met some folks at Lakeview and they wanted to develop a first responder program. They have a tremendous professionals track where, you know, they help executive type and working professionals and the first responders fitted right into that. But I was afraid of, in the beginning, I thought, well, you know, our guys and girls need a room or a treatment center that's just first responder, right? It should be only our guys and girls. But that was so wrong, my way of thinking. Now they're amongst other people who the common denominator is getting healthy, getting back, getting your life back in order and getting back to work and what doing what you love to do. And me helping others, it's tremendous. So we'll do, we have a great team here. The team is culturally competent. They've all been trained. They're ex-military or first responder families. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Lakeview's been around for 22 years, so they know what they're doing. So it's just they've been doing a great job. Any modalities we try to, input into the program, mm-hmm. they're welcoming to doing it. And they've given myself and my colleagues who are developing the first responder program. It's really starting to gain some traction now, you know. So looking into some brain mapping, which is another good thing, Bonnie. You know, mm-hmm. understand that we're big into we need to see results, right? First responders right. are results driven, visual.
Yeah, so
show me my brain and show me my trauma.
That's then right.
It's a faster investment, right? It's a faster turnaround.
Science back too, right?
It's very science back. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's good.
Stepping into a residential setting and setting into the safety and security, plus having a medical team to help through that detox process, without a setting like this, I don't know that I would have ever been able to commit to actually, you know, finding sobriety.
In residential treatment, you get a break from everything that's happening in the outside world, and you get to come in and focus on you.
I came in here and I had people that got me. They knew where I had been. They showed me love and compassion, and there was no judgment.
I know how scary this time can be, debating on whether to make this call or not. You know, I can tell you from a person in long-term recovery and a person that was probably sitting where you were sitting, making that call is so worth it. And you can have a great life and we can help you get there.
And Giovanni, you've mentioned before about how you've kind of transferred some of the skills and things you've learned in your career to help responders at Lakeview? Like, what are some of the things you pay forward and some of the transferable skills that work in that environment?
So if you go through a typical treatment, you're just kind of working on your addiction and you're trying to get that straight. But we try to get to the root cause. Where's the trauma? Mm-hmm. Is there some underlying trauma? How did you wind up being where you are right now? Why did you start becoming dependent on some kind of, whether it's alcohol, whether it's a over-the-counter or a legal substance? So much today, you know, and the mental health side of it is just, it's destroying our community. Mm-hmm. And the amount of suicides is just, you know, it's crazy. But we'll talk about trauma. We'll be trauma informed. We'll do trauma groups. And this way, our first responders will do breakout sessions, because we don't want to try, you know, we don't want to bring our stories to a bunch of working professionals that are here to deal with their stuff. But Lakeview is at least they're aware of the fact that we have to deal with the underlying trauma and what caused their problems. But then your typical patient might be in recovery because of the trauma they experienced when they were a child, or maybe something they were in a relationship. First responders are unique because we have to treat that past trauma, whatever causes to be here on or off the job. Mm-hmm. But Tim, what about the trauma? Because you know, David, if I show up for, you know, I'm found fit for duty next week, my first shift, chances are I'm going to catch a homicide, I'm going to catch an act of fire, I'm going to catch something. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're prepping them for all that trauma to come. Mm-hmm. So they give enough thought to it. And it is, we teach a lot of de-escalation techniques, a lot of effective communication in it, just to be aware of themselves and how they can go back to their job and see it a little differently. What's causing you to be so deregulated, right? I used to show up at bar fights or something. I was the guy that, you know, the dust was settling, and then I would kick the dust up again, you know, because I'm such a poor communicator. Do I walk in? And that's when breathing comes into place. And I didn't realize it was my fear. It was a fear of walking into a bar fight. Oh my God, now it's on. You know, I got to fight for my life. You walk in a little differently. You walk into a situation, maybe you're so, what you're seeing yourself being so callous and so scorned, and the department thinks this in me and they don't care about me. And I don't care, you know, now I got 15 years left in this job. Okay, well, let's redefine and repurpose you. If I could teach you breathing techniques, and I could teach you de-escalation, and I could teach you to have a lot more empathy when you go to a call. But guess what? You're going to be a better first responder. Your chief is going to love you when you come back. You're going to be getting awards for the way you behave. You know, you're not going to be getting demeanor complaints, use of force complaints on the law enforcement side of things. You know, you'll start to deal with your family a lot differently. And Lakeview is great for that. We do a family component. So we don't only just treat the first responder, we'll treat the family as well. So we include them, and from day one, they're included in everything that the responder is doing.
Does Lakeview offer any financial aid options, scholarship options? What does the payment structure look like, just in case people were wondering about looking into the program?
Yeah, most of the time we're in network with most of the major carriers and insurances. Sometimes guys and girls in the first responder world, they won't come and seek treatment until they've been suspended or until they're disciplinary and they don't have their benefits, or maybe they let them lapse or something. We'll always work with them. We'll never turn them away. We'll always find some, you know, partial scholarship, or not saying we're giving the farm away for free. We'll always work with that responder because we understand that they need the help. But most of the time, we're in network with their providers.
That's great to hear, because as a therapist, the two things that we bump up against the most when facing inpatient is the stigma and then the financial piece. So I'm happy to know that there are some options there.
Yeah. And the hardest part, Bonnie, is when we, you know, when somebody does want the help and they do the assessment part, they might call me. They might call my colleague Jose and reach out to us directly, or I might find them through David. And then I'll say, okay, well, listen, you know, I have to have you call the assessment team, and, you know, intake's going to do the assessment. And then all of a sudden they're so afraid of being judged. And most of the time you hear, well, wait a minute, I'm not here for alcoholism. Like, you know, I'm only drinking 9 to 12 beers a day, but that's not what I'm here for. I'm here for mental health, you know, because they think that the mental health component and just saying that they're burned out. Well, what is the, if you're dual diagnosed, because we don't treat primary mental health here at Lakeview, we do dual diagnosed, but you might be mismanaging your meds. You might be, you know, are you taking 4 shots of scotch or bourbon to go to sleep at night, you know, and waking up the next day, or, you know, you're not seeing it as, so the assessment team helps you understand, okay, you know, but it is. First responders, we have that Superman mentality, right? You know, I'm the protector and server. You know, I have to be there for everybody. Like, so it's hard to break that emotional armor, and we just chink at it and chip at it until we get them to understand, okay, yeah, you know what? I was mismanaging my meds. Yeah, I was supposed to be taking the prescription that the doctor gave me, but I haven't taken it in 10 days, or I take it when I need it. Well, that's mismanaging your meds. So it's just helping you get back to it, understanding that you need to be on your meds. You got to take your meds, you know?
Yeah, a lot of times first responders, I'm speaking generally here, but I think fairly accurate by saying that we make the worst patients, right? we're not good at being the receivers yes. of care.
Yes. We may even drive ourselves to the ER sometimes when we have issues.
We're great at giving advice, right? We're like Dear Abby 5.0. We're great at walking into a scene and you know, because again, we have that ability, we have that authority, especially law enforcement. They have the authority of walking in a room and telling everybody, be quiet. Be quiet. I'm now in charge, I'm taking over. And the minute you strip them of that, at times we make bad patients there because we're so manipulative.
Yeah.
That it's like, no. I see what you see. You know, Dr. Bonnie says that this she's wrong. She diagnosed me wrong. You know, there's a lot of that. You know, sometimes we just have to shut up and listen, right? Shut up and listen to what the therapists are saying, or, you know, or be open to what somebody is saying, you know.
Right.
And don't be afraid of what somebody else thinks of you. Listen, you should be burned out when you do this job. This job is the mental toll it takes on us, no matter what. And I was finished. My wife worked sex crimes for years. Now, here I am working as an undercover, and I'd be, you know, if I was doing a human trafficking case, I could be the person buying kids. As disgusting as that sounds, you know, if we're in a case where I have to buy kids or traffic kids, I'd come home and I'd be, you know, what a day, you know, I had to buy these kids or whatever. And she would say, yeah, no, I just interviewed a 3-year-old today. And, whoa, I don't want to hear that. And we're so like, I don't want to go there. That's too dark for me, you know?
Yeah.
So what does she do with that? Like, she would just, then it creates a lot of anger. Communication with family is everything. I will touch on that. When you walk in the door and you had a bad day, you know, how many times I grew up, don't leave daddy alone today. Let daddy sleep. Let him sleep. Let daddy, everybody be quiet, you know? And then you come home. One of the worst things that ever upset me was hearing it was a military vet told a story, and it resonated and still does to this day. He was so deregulated when he came home, he wasn't spending time, he was sitting on a couch and he kept looking at his little son. And I did it myself. And admittedly, I did a lot of times. And he'd look at his son and he's playing with his toys, making noise. And what are you doing? Stop doing that. Why are you doing that? Be quiet. You know, why are you doing it? Like, what are you doing that for? And then he realized, because he's 2 years old.
Man.
He's a little boy. He doesn't know that you're so deregulated or you're so traumatized in what you're going through and processing what you talked about before, the adrenaline dump. You know? Like, he didn't realize I had all this adrenaline dump going on and the slightest noises. So this 2-year-old making noise, and he's yelling at a kid. He doesn't know any better.
Right.
So have that open communication with your kids. Realize if you're putting the uniform on to leave the house, be careful. The news shows everything today. In the last few years with the social disorder, my son was young enough to think that his mom and dad were still active law enforcement. So he would panic every time I left to go to work. And, you know, so be careful. If you're wearing a uniform, maybe change when you get to your locker. You know, leave his mom and then change when you get to the house, the precinct.
You know, at the risk of sounding unpopular with this, quite frankly, it's not the children's job to, you know, be casualties to our jobs.
Right.
It's not right. It's not fair. So if anybody's listening and their child was the one on the couch last night, it's time to do something about it, because we need to also stop the transgenerational trauma that we transmit to our children. It's not fair. They didn't ask for it. And I think you really bring up a good point by showing that example.
Yeah. No, open communication is key with your spouse, with your significant other, and more importantly, your children. It's okay to tell them, listen, daddy had a bad day today. Mommy had a bad day. I will tell you about it, right? You know, I'm not going to tell you the gory details, but we'll touch on it later. I just need a little bit of time and I'm sorry, you know, or just sometimes come home. If there was something that happened on the news, I know in my family, you know, I lost family in the line of duty, and my wife's family, everybody would want to know the details. Of course they want to know the deal. They want to know if you're okay. They care about you. But instead of just coming in like a bull in a china shop, maybe you just come into your house and just, it was a rough one. When the time is right, we'll sit down and talk. And sometimes that's all the spouse needs to hear. right? Mm-hmm. They just want to know you're okay. They're not trying to get all the gory details out of you. They're not trying to pepper you. It's just, I just want to check the box and make sure you're okay. I'm good, babe. Give me a little while. I'll have a cup of coffee. I'll get a cup of tea in a little bit, or when the time is right. And sometimes just that, you know, is great. Because if you don't, then it's just, you don't get it. You know, then you start to, you become abusive, right? You become somebody that we're dealing with in the street. Mm-hmm. I say it all the time. And again, getting back to Giovanni Gatto versus Giovanni Rocco, I would never let a guy like Giovanni Gatto around my wife or my kids. Never. Never. And I discuss it when I do my presentations. A guy like him was a turd. I would never let somebody even speak to my wife that was at his level of gangster. Mm-hmm. And at the end, it wasn't until I relocated. And then my son one day sat down and he had all these plastic rings on his fingers, on his pinkies. And they were all little girls' jewelry. And he was emulating and trying to mimic Giovanni Gatto, not Giovanni Rocco. And as I sat there and talked to him, how was your day at school today? Was that right? You know, this kid's 5 years old. Like, he's sitting there talking like a gangster. And I didn't realize I'm sitting here, you know, he wanted to be more like a gangster than he did his own father. So, yeah, you got to be careful. You know, that transference of trauma rubs off, and you know, you just open communication is key. We talk about that a lot in our presentations and training. How to do it, right? How to sit down and speak with them. It's you have to include them in it.
Giovanni, on behalf of Bonnie and myself, I want to thank you for being with us here today on Respond to Resilience, sharing your story and all the great work you're doing out there. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, folks. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Like and subscribe, YouTube, Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Respond to Wellness Inc., and ResponderTV.com. We're also on BBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is ResponderTV.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.